Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Congresswoman Catherine Clark joins us from Hub Week to make the case for the impeachment investigation.
We have presented to us with credible evidence that there has been a true threat to the integrity of our elections by this president.
Also today, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg is ready to fight against Senator Elizabeth Warren's plans to break up big tech.
But look, at the end of the day, if someone's going to try to threaten something that existential, you go to the mat and you fight.
And the state's paid leave tax kicks in today. It will allow workers to take medical and family leave with less financial worry.
We've heard from younger workers who are looking forward to starting their family, workers who are caring for a parent or grandparent, who are looking forward to being able to take the time off they need.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We begin today in the Seaport, where the fifth annual Hub Week is underway. Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark helped kick it off this afternoon, and we grabbed some time with her after to talk about that and the news out of Washington this week. The news includes a New York Times report that on a recent phone call, President Trump asked the Australian Prime Minister for assistance in a Department of Justice investigation. The DOJ was looking into the origins of former special counsel Robert Mueller's own investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Congresswoman Clark told us how Democrats are responding to that and other developments.
We are discouraged to see that this seems to be a pattern with this president, to ask foreign governments to interfere in the election and to do investigations in favor for him. And it gets back to the core of the whistleblower complaint and why we have opened this impeachment inquiry. We have a president who is abusing the power of his office to ask foreign governments to investigate private American citizens in the case of the Ukraine. And that not only is an abuse of power, it is a betrayal of his oath of office, and it puts into jeopardy the integrity of our elections. Never mind, it's a national security issue for us as well as for our ally, Ukraine.
This is, I wonder if you see the Australian Prime Minister call as similar to the Ukrainian President call, only in that the Australian Prime Minister call doesn't seem to involve going after private citizens, and the Justice Department had already launched some kind of investigation. Do those distinctions matter?
You know, I think we are focused on the whistleblower complaint and the outline that gives us. But it does matter that this president seems to routinely put himself above the law, use the powers that are vested in him by voters for his own self-enrichment, for his own political advantage. That's at the crux of this. He is not above the law. And this, you know, this type of corruption is one that isn't going to be tolerated by the American people, and it is one that calls for the very serious action of opening an impeachment inquiry, something that nobody in the Democratic caucus did lightly or joyfully. But we felt it was our constitutional duty to take this next step, given the dangerous behavior of this president.
Speaker Pelosi resisted beginning an impeachment inquiry for quite a while. You've been in support for quite a while. Why do you think the speaker decided at this time to go ahead and do it?
I think because this is such a clear-cut case. We have a president who, again, has jeopardized our national security. and has admitted so in a White House that is not does not have as its hallmark truthfulness and transparency. Their own release of a memorandum, a summary of the transcript, showed that this conversation happened, that this president asked the president of the Ukraine for a favor, to put, you know, to look into and dig up dirt on Joe Biden, who is his leading presidential opponent. That is such an outrageous violation of everything that we hold dear, and a violation of his oath to faithfully execute the office of the president.
Congresswoman, I'd like to move from the president to some of members of his administration. We talked earlier about the call the president made to the Australian prime minister. He reportedly made that call at the behest of Attorney General William Barr. What do you make of Attorney General Barr's role in this whole landscape we're discussing?
Attorney General Barr seems to have forgotten that he works for us, that he works for Americans, that he is not supposed to be the lackey of the president pursuing debunked conspiracy theories, that he should be working on protecting civil rights, enforcing the laws of our country. And to see him on apparently some sort of worldwide journey to pursue the latest theory of this president is an abuse and a corruption of the Department of Justice and his position.
You say worldwide journey in reference to things like a trip he reportedly made to Italy, as well as the Australian prime minister, et cetera?
That's exactly right.
So let's also talk about Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. It's being reported that he was listening in on the call to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. This is something that he seemingly denied having knowledge about a few days ago when he spoke with ABC News's Martha Raddatz. Here's what he said when she first asks him what he knows about the complaint.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting that President Trump pressed the president of Ukraine 8 times to work with Rudy Giuliani to investigate Joe Biden's son. What do you know about those conversations?
So you just gave me a report about a IEC whistleblower campaign, none of which I've seen.
Now, obviously, he's not under oath. He's speaking to a member of the press. But what do you make of his response to Raddatz with that question?
Well, obviously, that wasn't even really a comprehensible response, because I think that he didn't know what to say when faced with a question that he knew he was on that call. And we can surmise from the evidence we're starting to see that this call was handled in a very different way than a call of this nature usually would be. In the words of the whistleblower, it was put in lockdown, a separate, highly secure setting to keep it out of the hands of other government officials and certainly the public. So that will be something that we look into. We look into how this call was treated. But at the heart of the question here is an abuse of power of this president. And again, his willingness to jeopardize our national security, the willingness to jeopardize the integrity of our elections for his own personal gain. That is the abuse of power that we are investigating. That is why we did not have a choice but to open an impeachment inquiry.
You mentioned that the Secretary of State, Pompeo, didn't sound like he knew what to say there. He definitely found his voice today. He sent a letter to your colleague, Representative Engel, the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House, saying in part, quote, "I'm concerned with aspects of the committee's request that can be understood only as an attempt to intimidate, bully, and treat improperly the distinguished professionals of the Department of State," end quote, and went on to say that he, quote, "will not tolerate such tactics," end quote. So the Dems have subpoenaed Secretary Pompeo. He planned on hearing depositions from five State Department officials just on the Ukraine call. The first was scheduled for tomorrow. What's the party willing to do if Secretary of State Pompeo or others from this administration just aren't going to cooperate with the inquiry?
You know, we have the power of the Constitution and of the very seriousness of impeachment proceedings on our side. But it really is something to watch Secretary Pompeo talk about being bullied at the same time that we have Donald Trump calling Adam Schiff a traitor and saying he ought to be arrested for performing his job as chairman of the Intelligence Committee. To have the president calling for civil war, really trying to turn
That's when he retweeted that tweet that said there would be civil war if he were impeached.
That's right. And, you know, trying to turn Americans against each other so that we don't look at his actions and we don't look at what he has done here and the abuse of power that that this call represents. And so we're going to follow the leads from the whistleblower complaint. We will do what we need to do. We are sending out the subpoenas. We are requesting depositions and documents to see where this leads us, because we're going to pursue the truth and we're going to put the facts before the American people.
To that point, what would you say to critics who would respond, there's something to this bullying language Secretary Pompeo is using, because the Democratic House has been trying to impeach the president on one front or another basically since he came into office?
Well, that's simply not true. We have been doing our constitutional obligation to perform oversight, which has been met with unprecedented stonewalling by this administration. And we have been pursuing that in the courts and winning. But it is a slower process. And what we have now, I keep going back to the Office of Inspector General for National Intelligence, who said this whistleblower complaint is urgent and it's credible. And that symbolizes a very different type of allegation and one that we felt we did not have any other choice but to pursue an impeachment inquiry, give us the constitutional powers to make sure that we can get to the truth and that we can put the facts before the American people.
Congresswoman, speaking of urgency, as we speak, federal Judge Amy Berman Jackson is holding a hearing over whether to immediately intervene in the Trump administration's record-keeping practices. We know the whistleblower complaint includes the White House's efforts to lock down all records of the Ukraine call. Do you think this kind of immediate intervention is necessary?
I do. I think that we need to act fairly. We need to be sure that we are thorough, but we also have to make sure that we are acting expeditiously as possible. We have presented to us with credible evidence that there has been a true threat to the integrity of our elections by this president. And in a little over a year, we are going to be holding presidential and congressional and local elections throughout the country. And we need to do everything we can to make sure that those elections are secure. And one of the reasons that I came out for impeachment in July was Mitch McConnell's absolute refusal to take up a bill that allowed states to help, to give them money to help secure their election processes and the ballot. And I just, at that point, said, we need to make sure that this administration, that we are using every tool we can to get the truth out and to protect the core of our democracy, which is the ability to have every vote count and to be free from foreign interference in our elections.
Okay, so you are joining us from the Seaport. You're at Hub Week. I do want to talk about that for just a minute. I know you just finished your presentation. You were part of the opening session, which was called The Pursuit. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We live in this incredible ecosystem of innovation, and it is exciting. It is important to the future of health, of transportation, of combating the huge challenges we have before us with climate change, income inequality. All of these issues are, we have incredible scientists and innovators working in this area to create those solutions for these very real challenges ahead of us. And how do we partner with government? What is the role? And how can we help each other create those solutions for the future?
That's Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark, who represents the 5th District. She's also the vice chair of the Democratic House Caucus. Congresswoman Clark, I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Stay with us. Coming up, leaked audio shows Mark Zuckerberg taking on Elizabeth Warren. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The battle between Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg continues. New leaked audio obtained by The Verge shows Zuckerberg pushing back on the Democratic presidential candidate's plan to break up big tech companies. Here he is in the audio speaking to employees in July.
But look, at the end of the day, if someone's going to try to threaten something that existential, you go to the mat and you fight.
Warren immediately responded on Twitter, saying Facebook engages in illegal competitive practices and repeatedly fumbles their responsibility to protect our democracy. For more on this story, let's turn to Hiawatha Bray. He's a tech writer for the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so this is a pretty revealing story. It's certainly not how Mark Zuckerberg speaks usually in public. What was your first reaction when you heard the audio?
My first reaction was, wow, these guys are definitely ready to go to the mattresses. This is red alert. And I think it shows that one of the ideas that Elizabeth Warren has come up with really could have even more traction as a way of dealing with Facebook's power than I had previously thought. I happen to be a very free market kind of person who is very, very leery of government intervention in business. Yet what we face here in the case of Facebook, and I think also with Google, are companies that are simply not responding to market discipline, because the people who are most affected by what they do, the consumers, are not really the customers. As the famous saying goes, we're the product.
All right,
we're what they're selling.
So let's,
and to be the I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, and then I want to play a little more audio. Finish that thought.
No, I was just going to say, to be protected, to protect the consumers from what they're doing, we can't rely on traditional antitrust measures being applied the way they've been applied, certainly since the Robert Bork school came into practice, where the idea was you only use antitrust if consumers are being directly harmed by what a company does. We're not being directly harmed by what these guys do, but they are doing a certain amount of indirect harm. And how do we get hold of that?
So there could be a legal fight coming. Let's listen to a little more of Zuckerberg in the leaked audio.
Warren, who thinks that the right answer is to break up the companies, if she gets elected president, then I would bet that we will have a legal challenge, and I would bet that we will win the legal challenge. Does that still suck for us? Yeah. I mean, I don't have to, have a major lawsuit against our own government. I mean, that's not, like, the position that you want to be in when we care about our country and, like, want to work with our government to do good things.
So what does he mean, do you think, when he says legal challenge, and are you right? Is it a good bet that they'd win?
I honestly don't know. Here's the idea. Elizabeth Warren has suggested that what we need to do to rein in Facebook, first and foremost, is to force the company to spin off certain of the acquisitions that it has made over the last several years, primarily Instagram and WhatsApp. These are two social media apps that are used by hundreds of millions of people all over the world. Now, why is that important? It's important because what Facebook is selling is what it knows about billions of people. And every time they have another channel that billions of people use, that adds to the vast quantities of data that they have, which they can then monetize to make ever more money.
So WhatsApp gives them more, basically gives them more fodder to monetize.
Absolutely. Now, you understand this is all based on the way artificial intelligence works. The way all this works is you're training computers to understand people by feeding them ever more data about people. And so the more data you collect, the more you know about them, and the more valuable is your advertising ability, because you can target exactly the people advertisers want. If you cut them off from Instagram, if you cut them off from WhatsApp, they lose access to huge amounts of data, which is immensely valuable. And they don't want to lose access to that data. And I can understand why. But on the other hand, it does raise at least the possibility of reducing the power of Facebook to basically control the global conversation, because they don't know quite so much about us.
So Hiawatha, Zuckerberg referred to Warren's approach as an existential threat to Facebook's business mm-hmm. model. It sounds like you're saying, yep, it is. Is that right?
It could be. I mean, you have to understand that one of the it's in the nature of this way of using data that you got to keep getting more and more and more. Why do you think Facebook and Google are so interested in trying to hook up Africa? Africa's the last place on the planet that A, doesn't have a lot of internet users. About 75% of people there aren't on yet. And B, the population is growing by leaps and bounds. Everybody wants to get in Africa and get at that data. China is a huge threat. And one of the reasons they're a big threat is simply because there are 1.5 billion people in China. That gives them a massive amount of data to analyze automatically, far more than, say, the population of the United States. If you're cut off from large continuing inflows of data, it really does weaken your competitive position. It really does. I don't know if it's existential, but it would definitely make Facebook a much weaker company.
I think Warren, it sounds like she's quite focused on the U.S. So she wrote on Twitter, here's what she wrote, quote, "What would really suck is if we don't fix a corrupt system that lets giant companies like Facebook engage in illegal anti-competitive practices, stomp on consumer privacy rights, and repeatedly fumble their responsibility to protect our democracy." Unquote. So those are three big accusations. They also seem focused on the U.S. portion of that Facebook, you know, consumer base.
Well, I think it is. I think it is. And I mean, she's running for the presidency of the United States, of course. But, you know, you've got a company that's just had to pay, a $5 billion fine for privacy violations. And they are a confirmed bad actor in this regard. But, you know, Mark Zuckerberg did make an interesting point, a fair point, when he said that this won't even solve the problem that they're claiming to worry about. And he's got a legitimate point there. Even if you strip away Instagram, even if you strip away WhatsApp, Facebook itself, the core company, still is sitting there collecting data on 2 billion people. If you're worried about Facebook manipulating our data and abusing our privacy, they'd still be in a position to do that.
Well, and Hiawatha,
none of the remedies that I've heard.
So let me just pick up on that specific point for a second, because Zuckerberg is actually arguing in response to all this that the size, the hugeness of the company is a benefit for solving problems like election interference. Here he is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just that breaking up these companies, whether it's Facebook or Google or Amazon, is not actually going to solve the issues. And, you know, it doesn't make election interference less likely. It makes it more likely, because now the companies can't coordinate and work together.
So I hear two things in that. One, you're saying, hey, even after some level of breakup, we're still talking about data on 2 billion people. So maybe the size thing isn't the threat that he says. But two, is there any credibility to this? You know, the smaller we are, the harder it is for us to be effective in fighting foreign intervention in an election, for example.
I'm not sure I buy that part of the argument. But for example, he's talking about coordinating with other companies. I don't see why they can't do that, even if they're a substantially smaller company. One of the reasons why we're going to have to work this whole issue of privacy much more carefully is because let's say you don't have any further restrictions on privacy and Instagram and WhatsApp remain as separate companies, then each of those companies still has this huge amount of sensitive data about billions of people. And so just breaking them up actually could be like the whole idea of the head of the Hydra, where you cut it off and two more grow in its place. If you end up with more companies that have this huge amount of data about people, so you can have it in one of two ways. Either you have a handful of companies with almost all the data flowing into those two or three companies like a Google or a Facebook, or you could have 10 or 15 or 20 companies, each one of them gobbling up huge amounts of data about each one of us. And I'm not sure which is worse.
Right, so
I mean, it could be a real problem.
So let me ask you then, let's get even a little more meta. You've heard the leaked comments. Do they tell us anything new about Facebook's leadership or about Zuckerberg?
I don't really know what they would tell us that's new. It's clear that he is very competitive. It's clear that he hasn't the slightest idea of drawing in his ambitions. Oh, by the way, you didn't mention that apparently he is intending to dig in and work very hard to try to get this whole Libra cryptocurrency thing off the ground.
Yep.
And that's one that is really, to me, rather disturbing.
And that's Facebook's
Libra
own cryptocurrency, right?
Right.
Libra is.
Libra in itself is not a bad idea, actually. If it were run by, I don't know, a consortium of nonprofit organizations or something, it might not be a bad idea. But I don't think we want a company with the size of Facebook having its own currency. They say that it's not going to work that way, that there are going to be a lot of other stakeholders, that they won't have that much power in it, but I don't want them to have any power in it. And
yeah.
I think a lot of other people feel that way. I think when a company is as big and as powerful as Facebook is, this is something that I would not like to see happen. The idea of something like Libra, an independent global currency, makes a lot of sense, but I wouldn't want it to be run by companies like this.
So just quickly, Hiawatha, what do you think Facebook does next? What's next for Zuckerberg in like 30 seconds?
Well, I think what's really next is we see what happens with all the states that are coming after them with antitrust proceedings. We see what happens with the investigations from the Justice Department, and they're just going to have to wait and see. But I think whoever wins the presidential campaign, whoever wins the House and the Senate, this is a company that has managed to alienate pretty much everybody, and they know that they're going to be under fire for years to come. And I think what he's doing is sounding a battle cry. We're ready to fight.
That is Hiawatha Bray, tech writer for the Boston Globe. Thanks for joining us, Hiawatha.
No problem. Glad to be here.
Now, we have some breaking news this hour. A federal judge has ruled in favor of Harvard University. The ruling upholds Harvard's race-conscious admissions program, with the judge finding that Harvard does not discriminate against Asian American and white applicants and that the university's admissions program is, in fact, constitutional. Stay tuned to WBUR for more on this story. We're going to go to a break, but stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Hey, Massachusetts residents, you're going to notice a little more money coming out of your paychecks. That's because new payroll deductions kick in today for the state's paid family and medical leave program. The estimated $800 million initiative is aimed at making it easier for workers to take time off for personal medical needs or to care for a family member or bond with a new child, all with less financial worry. The benefits will be available to every worker in the state and affect every employer. WBUR Bostonomics reporter Zeninger Enwemeka joins us now to talk more about the new payroll deductions and the paid leave program. Welcome back, Zeninger.
Hi.
Hi there. So, okay, what payroll deductions will workers start to see now?
So the new payroll tax is 0.75%, so less than 1%. Now, part of the tax will be paid by employers and part of it will be paid by employees. So the way it breaks down for workers is basically this. Workers will pay a maximum of 38 cents for every $100 they earn. So let's say someone makes $50,000 a year. They could see a deduction of roughly $189 a year. Now, it could be less than that if your employer offers a more generous leave package, but that's the max under the state program.
In return, what are the benefits workers get under the paid family and medical leave law?
Workers can get up to 12 weeks of paid family leave. So that's to care for a sick family member or bond with a new child or an adopted child, or to manage any family needs due to a family member's active duty military service. Workers can also get up to 20 weeks of paid medical leave, and that's to recover from a serious injury or illness.
My understanding is that the payroll deduction to pay for the program, it starts today. But can workers start taking this paid leave right away?
So that's a good question. In short, no. The benefits don't actually kick in for workers until 2021. The payroll deductions are starting now to fund the paid leave program. And I spoke with Andrew Farnitano about this. He's the spokesman for Raise Up Massachusetts, and that's the coalition of community groups and labor unions that led the push for the ballot measure on paid leave. He says workers are already planning ahead for these benefits.
We've heard from younger workers who are thinking about starting a family and looking forward to starting their family in 2021. We've heard from workers who are caring for an elderly family member, a parent or grandparent, who are looking forward to being able to take the time off they need.
And Farnitano says he's heard from workers who just feel a sense of relief that if something bad happens, they'll now be able to rely on this program.
So that's the workers. What about employers? What's their role? And do they also pay into the fund?
Yes. So employers do contribute to the paid family and medical leave program. Under the law, they have to cover at least 60% of the medical leave contribution, but they aren't required to cover any of the family leave contribution. Now, they could if they want to. Those are just minimum requirements under the state program. And under those minimum requirements, the employer's total contribution works out to be almost the same as workers' contribution. Now, understanding all of this and preparing for the start of these deductions is part of the reason why the tax was delayed from July until now. Businesses just needed more time. Some business groups are still concerned about managing the paid leave program. Christopher Carlozzi of the National Federation of Independent Business in Massachusetts says the program will be a challenge for small businesses.
When a new policy is passed that increases the cost of doing business for them, they can't spread it out amongst a couple different stores or throughout several different states. It's usually that one mom-and-pop business that has to absorb all the costs and find a way to deal with that.
And it's worth noting that for businesses with fewer than 25 people, those employers don't have to contribute to the state fund.
So once it's up and running, will the state program be the only option workers have for paid family and medical leave?
No. And as I mentioned before, companies can offer a more generous paid leave package. The state program basically sets some minimum standards. So an employer could decide to cover more of the paid family leave costs. Companies can also opt out of the state program entirely, as long as they get the state's permission. But they have to provide an alternative to their employees that's comparable. So a company can't go with a private plan and offer less benefits. It has to at least be the same as the state plan. And this private option was another reason the payroll deductions were delayed until now, because insurance companies also needed time to put together a private option. And now there are some of those private options available. Mutual of Omaha, the Hartford Financial Services Group, the Guardian Life Insurance Company, and Prudential Financial all told me that they will offer paid family and medical leave programs that fit the state's guidelines. Leston Welsh of Prudential Financial Group Insurance says the goal is really to give employers some flexibility.
We just partner with the employer, and the employer may decide to adopt a plan that is exactly like the state plan, and that's what we would price and support. Or sometimes employers may decide to enhance those plans. And again, we would provide that support.
Welsh says employers can add more benefits under their plan so they can stay competitive, especially in a tight labor market where they're often competing with other companies for the same workers.
So to that point, do we know if any companies are already planning to opt out of the state program and do something private?
Yes. As of the beginning of this week, the state says there have been over 800 applications from companies that are looking to opt out of the state program, and over 600 have received provisional approval. And I think we can really expect to see more employers going this route. Christopher Guerin of the Associated Industries of Massachusetts says many companies in his organizations are exploring a private option.
I think there's a sense that if companies can do this privately, they would prefer to do that rather than going through the state bureaucracy. So we'll see how many of those companies actually are able to secure a private option by the middle to the end of December.
And December is basically the deadline for companies to get approval from the state to go with a private option.
Okay, that is WBUR's reporter Zeninjor Enwemeka. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
Okay, again, breaking news this hour. A federal judge has ruled in favor of Harvard University, saying that the university's race-conscious admissions policy is constitutional and does not discriminate against Asian American and white applicants. Stay tuned to WBUR for more. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. Do join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.